This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As President-elect Bush's cabinet nominees face their confirmation hearings, consider this. The Bush team has to hire about 6,000 new people. That's just part of what makes the White House transition so tough. We invited two veterans of the transition process to talk with us about it. Boyden Gray worked for George Bush Sr. as director of the Transition Counsel's office. He's also a former counsel to President Bush. He's now a partner in the law firm William Cutler & Pickering. Mark Guerin was the deputy director of Bill Clinton's transition team and served as Clinton's director of communications and deputy chief of staff. He's also former director of the Peace Corps. He's now president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. I asked Boyden Gray of the Bush team what advice he gave the Clinton transition team as they prepared to move in.
Watch out for ethical minefields. And I don't know, you know, whether that really sunk in or not. Mark would have to answer. I'm not, there's no way you can warn people about what's about to happen to you anyway, if you haven't been through it. So I tried to warn some of the lawyers, beware the attorney-client privilege. It may not exist. Be very careful what you do. Think way ahead. I actually gave that advice in the White House mess. I was invited to the White House mess, and people looked at me kind of funny when they saw me there. These ethical minefields are very, very difficult, and there is bipartisan support, very, very strong bipartisan support. I think Mark Guerin would certainly agree with this, to deregulate, decriminalize, depoliticize the whole ethics regime. It's become a tool for disgruntled office holders, political enemies, estranged spouses, God knows what all, to destroy careers. And of course, it also destroys the whole point of the thing, which is to induce a measure of common sense and honesty in the government. So you lose both ways. You lose good people, and you lose the point of it all.
When you're talking about these ethical minefields, are you referring to the vetting process for, you know, security clearances for incoming staff and cabinet members? Or are you talking more generally than that?
I'm talking both. It starts with the vetting process, but it continues all the way throughout your government service. There are always people lying in the weeds waiting to trip you up on some minor infraction, which can be found no matter how good you are, because you have to fill out so many forms and update them and refile them, and there's no way you can do it perfectly. For example, the Form 278, which Mark Guerin will probably remember well, is your financial disclosure form, and it requires extraordinary detail, much more than could possibly be necessary to determine whether or not you have a conflict of interest. The only relevant question is, do you own stock in Company A? Not how many shares, not how many fractional shares, not how many options, not this, not that, just do you own or do you not? That's a simple question, but it turns out you have to answer about five different questions in five different ways. None of the terms that you have to use in filling out that form, which is incredibly intrusive, none of those terms line up exactly with what governs your income tax return. And for people with even modest personal assets, you are required to lie either to one or to the other, because you cannot reconcile them both, at least without the help of high-priced accountants and lawyers. So the whole thing becomes a game of gotcha, and it is totally out of control.
Mark Guerin, was this good advice that Boyden Gray gave you?
It was excellent advice, and it should be certainly imparted to the incoming Bush administration. I think there are a lot of what Boyden referenced, in addition to the advice that he gave to our lawyers in the White House mess, really now applies. It's a bipartisan concern about the need for reform in the system, the kind of forms that Boyden referenced, and the different kinds of forms that need to be submitted to both the Office of Government Ethics and to the White House Legal Counsel's office, and then to the United States Senate, if Senate confirmation is required for the appointment, places an extraordinary burden, and it delays the process. It's greatly frustrating to the individuals. People put their lives on hold for a period of time as this process winds its way through. And hopefully, if there's any silver lining to this abbreviated transition in the very difficult timeline that the incoming Bush administration is having to deal with, hopefully it will be that there'll be a look at reform in the system. How do we continue to recruit and attract and retain good qualified men and women into government, and not deny them the opportunity for public service, and not, more importantly, deny our country the opportunity to have talented individuals come in without burdening them right from the get-go of this process that is bizarre, antiquated, and really is a relic of the Cold War.
Oh, you mean investigating whether somebody is secretly a communist or something like that?
Yeah, it's just...
That's where it all began, yeah.
Well, let me ask you both about the kind of advice you gave to candidates for high and medium-level positions about how to look back on their past and come clean to you or to others in the administration before the vetting process. Did you urge people to mention to you, like, affairs that they had had? Did you really smoke marijuana in the past? I mean, these kinds of things that could come up and really blow up in your face?
Of course you have to ask those questions. It's very embarrassing. It's very intrusive.
Mm-hmm.
It's very invasive. And it is horrible. I can remember once transition... staff meeting one morning back in 1988, late 1988, after poor John Tower had been the subject of a Paul Weyrich press conference where he accused Tower of all manner of sin, drinking and wenching. And it was quite a firestorm. And the next morning when I went into the transition, they all glared at me, and the question was whether it was totally disqualifying ever to have had an affair. And I was on the spot because there were no rules about this. I hadn't talked to the president-elect about it, but I obviously couldn't spend the next 3 weeks trying to figure out what the rules are. Can you have one affair, two affairs, three affairs, or four? I mean, what was the... So I finally said, look, as long as you don't sort of flaunt it and you're discreet about it, who am I to question your private behavior? And everyone breathed a great sigh of relief. We have not yet had an affair... question come up that has driven a nomination. But I wouldn't be surprised to see it happen. I wouldn't be surprised to see any number of things come up in the future. It's a gotcha mentality, and it really doesn't matter. I mean, I think with Lina Chavez, she should have obviously been more forthcoming. Had there been more time, I'm sure she would have been sooner. The FBI would have uncovered it anyway. But it's a trivial matter, really. And I think there may be change in the wings, because I talked to Elaine Chao, an old friend of mine, and all of a sudden, for the first time, you know, a senator is faced with having to fill out the living room with papers all over the floor. Living room, dining room, and the library of their house is strewn with papers that they have to fill out, and Senator McConnell has to fill them out too. And all of a sudden, now for the first time, a senator is face to face with this horror that he has helped create, and maybe he will lead the fight to cut way back on it.
Senator McConnell, to whom you're referring, is married to Elaine Chao. Just for anybody who did kind of missed
and my
that,
point
so.
Was that yeah. All of a sudden now a senator has to go through the pain because the spouse is always held to the same standards as the working spouse or the other spouse. And we had this before with Senator Dole and Mrs. Dole, but life is much more complicated now than it was even when she served as Secretary of Transportation. So it's going to be interesting to watch. To see Senator McConnell helps us out here.
Paul Light of the Brookings Institute, who did a study of the transition process, said that he thinks that in the last few years of the Clinton administration, the appointments process really became the place where senators took revenge on the president. And many of the holds that were put on in the Senate confirmation process were unrelated to the nominee at hand. They were involved with all sorts of other issues. I'm wondering what you both think of that, if you agree with that. Boyd and Gray, what about you?
Absolutely. That's exactly what happens. Senators use nominees as hostages for other agendas. It's very unfair, but it's politics. I don't know how you change that. I really don't know. And what happens to people who get caught in this political crossfire can be devastating. And it really is something that ought to get changed, but I frankly don't know how to do it, except to say that we should legislate a total deregulation, if you will, decriminalization of all these issues, and I think the tone would change enough that people would say, all right, it's off limits, let's not pursue it anymore.
Well, I think one way the Senate could attack it, though, also, Boyden, is to look at the issue of the so-called Senate holds, where an individual member of the Senate is able to put a hold on a nomination for an issue totally unrelated to that particular nominee's background or the position or whatever. Historically, the Senate has done it anonymously. There's been some changes in that, but it's a procedural matter that the Senate could change to bring some greater sunshine to the process. I think folks would have to appreciate the complexity within individuals' lives who's not living in Washington, who's been asked to come to serve in an incoming administration, who would come with potentially a family and school issues related to children, and so they have to make real-world planning issues. How to do that in this environment when any individual senator can place a hold on something thoroughly unrelated, as Paul points out, Paul Light points out in his article, as a political matter against the president in the recent years, is greatly burdensome to someone coming in. And I think it must certainly retard anyone's interest in coming and serving in public service. There have been examples of it recently. Richard Holbrooke was held up for reasons that Boyne points out. Nominees have been held up. I heard it when I would travel around the world as the Peace Corps director, where countries would wonder when their U.S. ambassador was going to arrive at post. It's very hard to explain that it's nothing about our individual bilateral relations with this country or the president or the administration's view of the importance of that nation, but that it's involving a procedural issue of the United States Senate that is very hard for our friends around the world to understand why they don't have a sitting U.S. ambassador.
My guests are Mark Guerin, who was deputy director of Bill Clinton's transition team, and Boyden Gray, who was a director of George Bush Sr.'s White House transition team. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the White House transition process. My guests are Boyden Gray and Mark Guerin. Gray was the director of the Transition Council's office for George Bush Sr.'s transition team. Guerin is the former deputy director of Bill Clinton's transition team. Well, Boyden Gray, you said that the first advice, the most important advice you gave the Clinton administration when they were coming into the White House was watch out for those ethical minefields. What was the second most important piece of advice?
Well, the second was, I think I mentioned it, was to be sure you understand what attorney-client privilege means
right.
or it doesn't mean. And that became an issue quite important in the Whitewater and Monica Lewinsky matter. It was litigated several times in the courts and I think went to the Supreme Court. So, I mean, I think I hit two issues that I should have highlighted. On the ethics front, and I think that, you know, I worry that we made the mistake. The mistake I'm about to describe to you, I believe President Clinton made the mistake, and I worry that Governor and President-elect Bush is going to make the same mistake. We started out by saying we're going to be the most ethical administration and did a bunch of things in the first week, all of which had the perverse consequence of raising the sort of cries of hypocrisy from the media, making it easier for them to attack us later for the most minor infraction. The Clinton administration came in, and with all due respect to Mark, I think they compounded the mistake by saying they were going to be the most clean administration. And I hope now that Governor Bush won't feel compelled to do one up yet one more time and say we're going to be cleaner than all the cleanest of the clean in the past, because all it does every time you do this is overcomplicate things, add more rules that can be only be found to be broken. And allow the press to say, see, gotcha, you're not the cleanest, because look what you just did. You just dropped a chewing gum wrapper on the street.
Mark, here in the Clinton transition had a reputation for being kind of disorganized and mm-hmm. and slow. And apparently mm-hmm. there were a lot of jobs that went empty for a really long period of time. What was the yep. biggest problem, looking back in self-critique, that you yeah. think the Clinton transition had?
Well, I think it was both the transition and then into the administration. And there's a couple of dimensions to it. I think as Democrats coming into power after 12 years of being out, there was a lot of pent-up demand, if you will, for people wanting to come into government, excitement about a young, new administration. And the sheer volume of that had a dimension and burden on both the transition staff and then the eventual White House staff. Secondly, because of being out of power for 12 years, we did not have the experience within the White House staff of folks who had served in the federal government before at an executive-level position to come into it. And third, of course, with the president not having direct Washington experience, and he's been rather frank and and honest about this with great candor, I think, in the limitations that that brought to the early days of his administration. I think if he were to do it over again, it would have been a speedier decision-making process for him to make some of the initial judgments on personnel choices. Because the reality is the process itself, the forms, the vetting, the nomination, the Senate confirmation, all of that is so cumbersome that to then exacerbate it with without a streamlined decision-making process for the president, for his ultimate decision or his delegation of that decision, just compounds the process. So it all of those added up into a process that was far too lengthy and time-consuming. And I think people learned a lot from that. I would say, and what the Brookings Institution observes, is this is a growing trend for delayed appointments, that what used to be an average in John Kennedy's administration of 1 to 2 months is now easily and routinely 6 to 9 months. With that and in parallel track is the growth of the sheer numbers of presidential appointees. They used to be far more modest. That's what Boyden's referring to, the proliferation of presidential appointees at the assistant secretary and the sub-deputy assistant secretary level that all requires confirmation. So it's both the added timeline, the politicization of it, the gotcha mentality that frequently invects the process.
Are there any major differences in the transition process for George W. Bush as compared to George Bush Sr.?
This transition is more like, in the sense of not being an intra-party transfer, this is more like Reagan coming in, taking over from the Democratic Party in 1981. When President Bush became president, he was taking over from his mentor, his president, Reagan. So we didn't have to fire everybody. We were happy to keep quite a few. But it was difficult and emotionally difficult for this reason, precisely because it was friendly. It was very hard to tell some people that they had to make way for some of President Bush's loyalists. And that was the most painful thing about it, the least fun, because you couldn't assume all the people who were there were going to leave. They were all part of the team. They had all helped you get elected. And all of a sudden, some of them were going to have to leave. And that was very, very difficult.
Boyden Gray, is it your impression that the contested vote has poisoned the transition process at all?
No, I don't think it's poisoned. It's just truncated it. But I don't think it's poisoned
but,
in any
by
way.
By poison, I mean, do you think there's any more animosity between the outgoing and the incoming administrations?
Well, I don't know. Mark may have a better insight, but I've heard no complaints from the people that I work with from the outside, of course, but the people I work with and talk to who are in the transition, I haven't heard one single word of complaint about tension or difficulty with the outgoing administration. Not a single word. And I'd be very surprised if there were any sort of sabotage or going on. I think the transition, by and large, has gone very, very well. The public seems to be giving it high marks. And so I think there may be long-term consequences, of course, for governing from the Florida situation, but I don't think it's affected this transition period.
And I think, Terry, really President Clinton set the tone in working with his chief of staff, Mr. Podesta, to ensure that the outreach was there, the briefings, even, frankly, before the final decision from the Supreme Court on the contested election was finalized, that they had access to information. I think Vice President Gore reinforced that with his very elegant and eloquent statement to the country. And that with that tone set from the top, that makes a very real-world difference, I think, to folks throughout the government. That is the tone. That's the professionalism that I think they want to bring to bear in this. And that's the best part of public service, where we can transcend the partisan divisions at this point and prepare the next president in his administration. Because I think most people at senior levels of government realize even with a full transition, even on the best of days, these are very difficult jobs for people to come into. To encumber them at the start for some cheap shots or hijinks along the way would be inappropriate. So I'm glad that that's Boyden's perspective, and that's certainly my observation from talking with friends and former colleagues.
What will you each be doing on Inauguration Day?
I'll be watching the inauguration.
On TV?
On TV.
Boyden Gray?
I don't know whether Mark's going to have to watch me. I may have to do some TV program early Saturday morning, but I'll probably be I'll probably be somewhere along the route watching. There are several receptions on Capitol Hill for incoming senators and whatnot that I feel I probably have to go to. So I'll be running from reception to reception and hoping to grab a bite to eat somewhere and hoping to watch. I may be watching it on television myself. I may duck into a congressional office and just watch it on TV rather than try to strain my neck and bear the cold. I don't know what I'm going to be doing, actually, but I'm sure I'll be enjoying myself.
It's a great day and a very memorable one for those that are privileged to have worked on a campaign and then to come into an administration. There's nothing quite like that excitement, and so it's certainly exciting for those involved.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
My pleasure.
Boyden Gray was a director of George Bush Sr.'s transition team. He's a partner in the law firm William Cutler & Pickering. Mark Guerin was deputy director of the Clinton transition team. He's now the president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.